adjust this a little bit. All right. So the disciples were not some group of already formed preachers, evangelists, and healers. They were not pre-formed. They were people who were feeling empty in their work when they met Jesus, and they stayed with him because they needed renewal. And Jesus offered them something they had never felt or seen before. They stayed because he loved them in a way they had never been loved. And when you are loved in this way, some transformation happens. They were captivated with Jesus, and they wanted to learn in the same, to love in the same way he loved. And they received Jesus' gift, and then, as is true for, I believe, all humans, they wanted to contribute, to reciprocate, and to help heal the world. This included not only the disciples, but people like Zacchaeus, the chief tax collector. Zacchaeus was essentially a Roman lackey. Friedrich Buechner writes, he was a Jewish legman for the Roman IRS, who followed the practice of the day, raking in as much and more than the going tax as he could get, and pocketed the difference. He was a Jewish man who found the only way in advancement for a person who's under the Roman Empire, and he found that slot where he could take advantage of his compatriots. But Zacchaeus had heard about Jesus, and he, like the disciples, wanted to get closer to Jesus. Zacchaeus, because of his unpopularity, had a question. How can Jesus love me? How can Jesus love me? How can I, a loathed tax collector, be received by Jesus? And how might I make amends and love others? He was wondering, how can I free myself from my role, my history, the bed I've made for myself? How can I become more human, more like Jesus? I want to begin looking at the human condition, the things that all of us experience as humans. None of us has exactly the same story as another, and I'm pretty sure none of us has been bathed in Jesus' unconditional love. The fullness of love the people who lived with him had never experienced either. Black and white, rich and poor, we have all experienced feeling we were not enough, forever exiled from paradise, mired in the human condition. In our American culture, for the last 400 years, however, Black people not only experienced these very human feelings, but experienced the effects of inhumane laws built on a caste system that was built on human fabrications of what's of value and what's of worth applied to people. Isabel Wilkerson, has anybody read her book, Caste? I highly recommend. It's one of the best books I've read in the last 20 years. She, in her book, Caste, she names these fabrications, the eight pillars, she calls them, of a caste system. That God wills racial division, that people can be ranked, and this rank follows in successive generations. That who one loves has to be controlled, that some people are more pure than others, that work must also be ranked according to caste, that dehumanizing people of color reinforces they are inferior, and that privileged human beings could determine inherent superiority versus inferiority. It's stark. Most of us growing up in a racially toxic culture, and I didn't know I was growing up in a racially toxic culture, but I was. Most of us growing up in that culture, the one that also rewards achievement and stardom, we have been taught that we are not enough. That is, we grew up with and still harbor some kind of shame of feeling not measuring up and not being good enough. It is part of our human journey, and I'd like to add that it is fundamentally a spiritual journey to discover that we are enough. Each one of us is enough. And while us white folks have experienced some feelings of shame, people of color experienced a systemic form of hatred that ascribed unworthiness to the color of their skin, that those of us who have fair skin have never known. This question of how to love and be loved, including loving oneself, that Zacchaeus was pondering, resonates with all of us, I believe. I trust it is asked by those with power and those without power. Ruby Sales grew up in Alabama. She saw and experienced the power of the state at a time of radical corruption, in which the state in its many forms of law, jurisprudence, executive order, was not accountable. In 1965, as a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, she joined 30 people protesting the maltreatment of their sharecropper parents in Lowndes County, Alabama. Many of the protesters were jailed for 6 days and then suddenly released, which was a tactic to prevent them from gaining support and protection upon release. This happened in, what did I say, 1965? I was 7 years old. I had no clue this was going on in the world. So they were released in this surprise way, so they didn't have protection. And of course, there were no cell phones in those days. So they were purchasing food at a local store, and a local highway department employee pulled a gun, meaning to shoot Sales. At that moment, Jonathan Daniels, an Episcopalian seminarian trained at Virginia Military Institute, pushed her away, taking the bullet intended for her and dying instantly. A white jury acquitted the gunman. Sales herself was traumatized by the shooting and barely spoke for 7 months. On top of a community of hate in which she grew up and the trauma of the shooting, now she was vulnerable to survivor's guilt. It's hard to imagine love being powerful enough to support someone to recover from an environment that seemed to refine itself only in hating more and more powerfully. Sales grew up in the America that Wilkerson writes about, where the narrative was that black people were inferior and should hate themselves as white people around them hated them. Reverend Jackie Lewis is a Presbyterian pastor and activist, and she interviewed Ruby Sales in February of this year. Ruby explained how the black community has survived this death spiral of a narrative over the many hundreds of years they've experienced it. In her lifetime, it was only in the last 50 years. This is what Ruby said. Out of the black community in the South, you have a kind of agape love, unconditional love, growing up. I loved everybody. And in order to love, we had to counter the narrative that we were nobody, with the sense that we were somebody. And that meant self-love. The pedagogy and theology of somebody-ness is how she says it. I'm a child of God, she said, and being a child of God, I'm essential, and no one has a right to limit or the power to limit my ability to be somebody. So I grew up in a society where that theology was powerful. Perhaps some of our demons actually tell some of us, that we're not just enough, but in fact we're more important than others. I'm sure we either have experienced that or we know people and we observe that in others. I submit these demons too are hiding the truth, that beneath our any overinflated sense of self is hurt, woundedness, an inability not only to love ourselves, but to love others as equals. Humans can do both, overinflating our sense of self or diminishing our sense of self, and both reveal our woundedness. This woundedness is something we share. We are truly more alike, all humans, than different. Alike, more than different. As Henry Nouwen writes, nobody escapes being wounded. We are all wounded people, whether physically, emotionally, mentally, or spiritually, or all four. The main question is not how can we hide our wounds so we don't have to be embarrassed, but how can we put our roundedness in the service of others? I included that in the call to worship because that's such a beautiful phrase. How can we put our roundedness in the service of others? When our wounds cease to be a source of shame and become a source of healing, we have become wounded healers. Whether our demons tell us we are not enough or we are more than enough, we all have a choice: to look away or to look within, with honesty and own it all. Only a deep, honest reflection, naming that all of this hurt is part of us, and in fact it belongs and in part is part of us. Only this path is the beginning of healing and discovering love. This inner journey is a journey in which lament is very powerful. I believe it has to be part of our journey. Lament is not a veneer of optimism to get through our hurt in some expeditious way. Lament does not minimize pain, both the pain we feel and the pain we have stimulated for others around us. Lament does not deny true feelings and true thoughts. Lament does not abide in platitudes about how to get along with others amid death-dealing practices that ruin lives. My friend and fellow pastor Teresa Latini writes, "Lament protests the absence of God in our great distress and reminds God who God is. In so doing, we remember who God is too. You are our healer. You are our provider. You are our rescuer. Now do it because we can't," she writes. It sounds like she's saying that God is sometimes present and needs to be reminded. In reality, we affirm that God is always present. How could God not always be present? But lament acknowledges our inability to see God's presence and power sometimes. In our confession, in our lament, we might acknowledge our weakness and also in that process discover not only God's presence and power, but our power. So lament leads us into the possibility of renewing and discovering our own power. We might discover that lament is faith's alternative to despair. Cindy Bourgeau, I think is how you say her name, uses a great metaphor in the book, The Wisdom Way of Knowing. I have not read the book, but I love this little story. Once upon a time, in a not so far away land, there was a kingdom of acorns nestled at the foot of a grand old oak tree. Since the citizens of this kingdom were modern, fully westernized acorns, they went about their business with purposeful energy and engaged in a lot of self-help courses. There were seminars called Getting All You Can Out of Your Shell. There were recovery groups for acorns who had been bruised in their fall from the tree. There were spas for oiling and polishing those shells. and various acornopathic therapies to enhance longevity and well-being. One day in the midst of this kingdom, there suddenly appeared a knotty little stranger, apparently dropped out of the blue by a passing bird. The creature was capless and dirty, making an immediate negative impression on the fellow acorns. And crouched beneath the oak tree, the creature stammered out a wild tale. Pointing upward at the tree, it said, "We are that." Delusional thinking, obviously, the other acorns concluded. But one of them continued to engage him in conversation. "So tell us, how would we become the tree?" "Well," the creature said, pointing downward, "it has something to do with the ground and cracking open our shell." "Insane," they responded, "totally morbid. Why, then we wouldn't be acorns anymore." I'm guessing it may be a bit scary to think about talking openly about the tension and conflict that some people experienced here at Church of the Three Crosses with our previous pastor, Britt Cox, especially in the upcoming restorative circles. But I am confident that as part of our renewal, we are working to crack our shells, maybe even take them off, and tilling the soil, ready to plant our little acorn selves into the rich soil. I trust in the miracle of growth and renewal, and the possibility of becoming a mighty oak, each one of us, or perhaps together becoming an oak savanna, a cluster of oaks on the edge of the meadow. It is also Reformation Sunday when we remember that the church has withstood seismic change, earthquakes to an institution, if you will. Those who study the church today tell us we're in the midst of another seismic change. We are again going through birth pangs, even as there were in Luther's time. The Spirit continues to work in the fractured vessel that is the church, and the earthen vessels that are our bodies. The good news is that we have colleagues, fellow saints, who have words of wisdom for preparing ourselves and working on church revitalization. I believe I mentioned that I heard Brian McLaren and Diana Butler Bass recently on a webinar I did. They tell us that the church in the future will look very different from the church many of us grew up in. Very different. I hope you will prepare yourself for a pastor who understands the church is changing and can help chart this new path here at Three Crosses. Amen.